Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Governor Gavin Newsom presented a record-breaking $286.4 billion budget, which includes a $45.7 billion surplus. The governor's priorities, the pandemic, climate change, homelessness, economic inequality, and public safety. Many of the same things he allocated for in last year's budget. But this is a wish list and will look different when the budget is finalized for the May revise. CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon sat through the three-hour presentation and breaks down how this will translate into the lives of Californians. Nicole, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Vicky.
So you sat through nearly 3 hours of the presentation. Were there any standout moments for you?
I mean, these are always very long and wonky events, and it was actually closer to 4 hours. But I, you know, just being in the room, I was kind of surprised how many people were there considering this surge in the pandemic. There were several dozen members of the governor's staff and press, but everyone was rapid tested before being let in the room. And then they also required N95 or KN95 masks. But a lot to get through, you know, in the budget. Like you said, I like to call it a governor's wish list. He's letting the legislature know what his priorities are for the coming year. But crafting a state budget is a process that takes many months, and he will do this kind of presentation again in May, when we have a better picture of tax revenues and the state's overall finances. And then he'll negotiate with the legislature over a final budget, which is passed in June.
This is another budget surplus year. How does it compare to last year's?
Well, the projected surplus is not quite as big as last year's. At this moment, it's projected at $45.7 billion right now. That is still a huge amount of money, but it could always change the way the monthly revenue numbers have been coming in. That surplus may get even bigger, but his Department of Finance warned that if things go south with this variant or something else happens, that surplus could shrink. And like I said, we'll have a better idea of what will happen there in the next few months. And that's when Newsom says he'll decide about stimulus checks, which is a big issue that's out there. And in fact, he was asked about this the other day. Here's what he said.
That number will substantially, most likely substantially, change between now and May. And so we are awaiting more contemporary information and data, more reflected of what is currently happening, before we had to put this budget to bed to ultimately make that determination. My sense is, to your question, that yes, there likely will be substantial contributions back to the taxpayers. What form they come in, we'll work with the legislature, and to what degree, in terms of total amounts of dollars, will be determined more closely in May.
I want to, you know, talk about the state appropriations limit here. It's also referred to as a GAN limit, which is, you know, something we may have heard something about before. That will likely come into play. It will come into play if the surplus stays this large. And, you know, the GAN limit is a cap on state spending. It's this complicated formula, but basically it says that if there's any spending over a certain amount, the state will have to split that in half, put half toward its schools and half as a taxpayer rebate. And that could be, you know, a way around, or that could be what stimulus checks are, is this taxpayer rebate.
You know, given that there is yet again another budget surplus at a time when there continues to be economic hardships from the pandemic, gas prices, supply chain issues, can you remind us or explain why there is a surplus?
Yes, very good question, because I know a lot of people, you know, are looking at their own pocketbooks and then looking at this huge surplus that the state continues to have and scratching their heads a little bit. But California has a very diverse revenue stream. Basically, it pulls funding from a lot of different sources. It's got sales tax, income taxes, you know, capital gains taxes from the stock market. And a lot of this surplus is coming from the state's wealthier earners. As we've heard over and over, those higher earners have done better during the pandemic than lower income people. And the state pulls more income taxes from them. It also gets money from businesses that have also done well, larger corporations, and that stock market doing so well has also helped the state. I think the Department of Finance said that this year is the largest year for capital gains taxes in California so far.
Given that we're entering the third year of the pandemic, what did the governor say about allocations towards fighting COVID-19 in the state?
Yeah, a lot of the money he proposed on this is to deal with the surge we're in right now. So increased testing, new vaccination and booster campaigns, including money for in-home testing and vaccinations. And he's also asking for funding to support hospitals that are dealing with the surge. Staffing is a huge issue right now, so a few hundred million there. And about half of this money the governor is asking the legislature for right now rather than in June, which is when a budget is normally approved. In total, he's asking for about $2.7 billion for the pandemic. An interesting side note, his administration said over the weekend that their estimate so far for the total pandemic cost since 2020 is $11.2 billion, a lot of money.
Wow, that is a lot of money. Climate change, the state has allocated previously a lot of money towards that. What are the allocations this year that the governor's proposing?
Well, the governor skipped the UN climate summit last fall, but, looking at this budget proposal, he is putting his money where his mouth is as far as funding projects to reduce emissions and head off impacts of climate change. I think we've got some tape of him talking a little bit about that funding.
We put an unprecedented $15.1 billion to commit to address the existential issues of climate change last year. This was unprecedented in U.S. history. No state coming close, even on adjusted per capita basis. This year, we're taking it to a whole nother level with an additional $22.5 billion.
Now, that $22.5 billion is not just for this year. It will be paid out over 5 years based on his proposal. But it is an enormous amount of money, and it would be spread out over all kinds of things. There's $6 billion for zero-emission vehicles. Big ticket item there is electric buses for, local governments and schools, also charging stations around the state. The budget does include $4 billion for high-speed rail. And there's money for this transition that Newsom is envisioning away from fossil fuels, so capping oil wells. He talked quite a bit about creating an energy innovation center at Cal State Bakersfield, which is located in the heart of California's oil industry, so kind of the green push in that area of the state. There's also money for tax credits for companies that are working on green technology. And some funding for home energy efficiency, things like rebate programs for people that are swapping out appliances to be more energy efficient.
Well, springboarding off climate change hand in hand are wildfires and wildfire mitigation and response. What type of money or what amount of money does he want to apply to that?
Yeah, so his budget and proposal includes $1.2 billion for forest management projects. So that's things like, forest thinning and prescribed burns. It also includes reforestation after a fire, which is also very important. That is less than the money allocated last year, which was $1.5 billion. But there have been reports that Cal Fire just has had a hard time spending that kind of money fast enough for forest projects, which can take time and research to, actually come to fruition. This budget proposal also includes hundreds of millions for firefighters, overtime pay and hopefully hiring additional firefighters. And then $248 million for new equipment, things like air and ground tankers. We haven't talked about water or drought yet. Last year's budget included a ton of money, $5 billion for water projects. Newsom proposed an additional $750 million this year. That doesn't include additional drought contingency money. He's kind of setting aside and deciding later in the spring how things look and if that needs to be spent. But Republican lawmakers from drought-stricken areas have said that this is not enough. They're really pressing the governor to fund more water storage projects as we experience more and more extreme drought.
Right, and a dwindling snowpack. Let's take a listen, a brief listen to an excerpt of the governor when talking about allocations for wildfire spending.
A two-year commitment for a multi-year investment on forest health and fire protection, the likes of which this state has never seen, and is necessary to combat the ravages of the extremes and issues related to wildfires. $2.7 billion is being proposed.
And as you mentioned, spending it is another. Spending it wisely is another.
Absolutely. And that $2.7 billion, you know, he names these numbers, but they include funding that he's proposing for this year and funding that he's already been allocated for last year. Mm.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon about the governor's budget proposal. Homelessness, obviously a topic the governor focuses a lot on. 2 years ago, in his State of the State address, focused solely on the issue and a crisis across the state. What did he have to say about homelessness in regards to money, the state budget?
Yeah, well, okay, when it comes to homelessness, there are several different angles here. It's a huge issue. The most glaring problem is tent encampments across the state. You know, people see these on their drive to work. They see them, you know, outside their neighborhoods. And the governor has called these unacceptable. He said it's inhumane that people are living in them and that people are literally dying on the streets. As we've seen, you know, here in Sacramento, sometimes these encampments get cleaned up. I'm kind of putting that in air quotes because they move the tents or throw them away, but people still have nowhere to go, so they camp out somewhere else. So the governor is proposing a few things here. One is to continue building tens of thousands of transitional short-term housing for unsheltered folks. He's mentioned tiny homes. Another is to increase treatment beds for people that are severely mentally ill and living on the street. And I think we have a clip of Newsom talking a little bit about his plans here.
$1.5 billion to focus on getting people off the streets, particularly those that are struggling, many duly diagnosed, self-medicating with drug or alcohol addictions, those with behavioral health issues, those that have mental health and substance abuse issues. We have to target what's happening on the streets. And this year's budget, if there's any message I want to drive, it's this next slide message. We want to cut red tape this year, focus on behavioral health, and we are investing 55,000 new homes and treatment beds with this two-year commitment.
One thing that caught people's attention in this presentation is that the governor also mentioned using conservatorships to get people into treatment. He talked about conservatorship reform, and this is a pretty controversial idea. It came up during the recall last year. Some of Newsom's GOP challengers floated it. And the governor mentioned it, but he was asked a few times, did not really elaborate, and just said that we would learn more in the coming weeks.
You know, within this nearly 4-hour presentation that you sat through, there's also, you know, a Q&A with journalists. The governor was asked about homelessness as well. I mean, what did he have to say about criticisms from people who say they haven't really seen any change in their cities regarding homelessness, despite the massive amount of spending for this issue?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he points out that there was no plan to address homelessness on a statewide level when he came into office 3 years ago. There was a little bit of money, but it doesn't even come close to the amounts that Newsom is proposing, you know, to deal with this right now. And he also touts his Project Homekey program. He says that's put about 8,000 people into housing since the start of the pandemic, using old hotels that have been reworked. But he says he's been putting together a real roadmap these last few years. Last year, it got billions of dollars, $12 billion. This year, he wants to build on that. But yes, if the state is spending $14 billion over 2 years, like Newsom is proposing here, I think people will expect to see marked improvements in their communities on homelessness.
And finally, overall, what about addressing economic inequality, which has just been exacerbated in the last 2.5 years?
Yeah, there's kind of a grab bag of different things here. The one that was most interesting to me, I think, is he wants to pause the gas tax increase. Republicans in the legislature have been pushing this gas tax holiday. This does not mean that the gas tax will disappear this year. You know, we pay the highest gas taxes in the nation. If this happens, it just won't increase as it's scheduled to, which is a few cents a gallon in July. There's also about $1 billion for mortgage relief for struggling homeowners. Newsom wants to extend a low-income health program, Medi-Cal, to all undocumented immigrants. Right now, that's open to people 26 and under, and then later this spring, it'll be open to 50 and older. So there's still this age gap for undocumented immigrants who are low-income, who need health care. He wants to cover everybody. A few more things. He wants, he's proposing another year of free school meals for all K through 12 students, more subsidies for childcare providers so they can increase slots for working parents, and then hundreds of millions in tax credits, and COVID relief grants for small businesses.
The big
and again,
oh, keep going.
No, go ahead. No, I was just going to say, like, my final point is, again, these numbers are just a starting point. They will absolutely change in the next 4 to 5 months.
Great minds think alike. That you literally took the words out of my mouth. So thanks, Nicole. We'll talk about the budget again come May.
Thanks, Vicki.
And that is CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon. Up next, the chairwoman of the California Republican Party joins us about where she sees a path forward and priorities for the midterm elections. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Politics. That word alone sparks a conversation that is rarely smooth or straightforward. There was a time, though, when it led to a lively, robust, respectful debate. But as of late, some would liken it to nails on a chalkboard. Both Democrats and Republicans are sifting through their own divisiveness and fracturing within party umbrellas. But in recent years, the fastest growing voter registration in California is no party preference. Currently, just over 23%. That rivals the California Republican Party at 24%. Democrats and third parties make up the remainder at roughly 46% and 6%, respectively. But despite waning representation, the California GOP is successful in powerful congressional districts, like House Minority Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and at the state capitol, making up about 23% of the state legislature, with 19 assembly members and 9 state senators. And midterms come with another curveball, thanks to special elections colliding with redistricting. We're going to spend some time getting a roadmap of the GOP's priorities this year. Joining us is Jessica Milan Patterson, chairwoman for the California Republican Party. Welcome, Chairwoman Patterson.
Hi, Vicki. Thanks for having me.
Well, your bio leads with the fact that you are the first woman, first Latina, first millennial to chair the California Republican Party. This is your second full year as chairwoman. So I guess through those lenses and lived experiences, how does that shape how you lead the party in the state?
So I'm actually already in my second term. So I finished up my third year come this February, and it'll be our fourth year once we finish up the election. And, you know, there was a lot of those headlines when I was first elected in February of 2019. But the diversity of the leadership in the Republican Party didn't stop with just electing me as chairman. Our state board is about 23 members, almost half of which are women. Since I was elected, we've had 5 Latinos on the board. We've had 2 African-Americans, 2 openly gay men. We have a Taiwanese immigrant as our vice chair, a kick-butt Punjabi Indian-American civil rights attorney, Harmeet Dhillon as our national committee woman. So the diversity of our party in the leadership doesn't just stop with me. And this is something that we focused incredibly hard on with recruitment of candidates in the last cycle. And you saw it. We sent 2 of the first Korean American women to ever serve in the United States House of Representatives in Michelle Park Steele and Congresswoman Young Kim. So this is something that has been important to make sure that we are engaging within communities that have been neglected by our party in the past. Talk about the failures of California Democrats and what our solutions would be.
You've served for the Republican Party statewide and nationally for close to 2 decades. How do you sum up the evolution of the California Republican Party during that time period, going back to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2003?
Yeah, so certainly, Governor Schwarzenegger was a one-of-a-kind candidate. I don't know that we could ever duplicate that type of enthusiasm and excitement. And certainly, he came at a time when Californians were looking for change from what was happening under Democratic leadership. I feel like here in California, we're at that turning point again. It's hard to tell. Usually you can't tell the turning point until you've actually reached past it. But once it happens really fast. And I think in this next year, it's going to be incredibly difficult to run with a D behind your name. The policies of California Democrats have failed Californians miserably. And we've seen it. People are voting. They're voting with their feet. For the first time in our state's history, we lost a congressional district because
our population still grew, though it just didn't grow as fast as the rest of the country.
So the first time in our state's history, we lost a congressional seat. Where did it go? It went to more business-friendly states. So we're seeing these opportunities throughout the state where the Californians that are staying and willing to fight are ready for a change. Whether you're talking about the surge in crime and how California Democrat policies have led to this, whether it was Prop 47, Prop 57, AB 109, is it decriminalized and changed the way our prison systems worked? These are all affecting. We saw smash and grab holidays. We saw a 31% increase in homicides in the last year. People don't feel safe. And this is a direct reflection of the policies that California Democrats have championed.
Well, I'm curious then, going back to the gubernatorial recall election, Governor Newsom beat that handedly. What were the learning lessons from the recall election, which was just last September?
Yeah, I think certainly there was, it was a heavy lift from the beginning. Your colleagues in the mainstream media, and certainly people on the left didn't even think we'd be able to qualify a petition to recall the governor.
Well, I moderated a gubernatorial recall debate with three candidates.
Yeah. And there was, I think, a certain amount of excitement that we were able to accomplish that. And I think from the recall effort, we saw a lot of successes. I don't think that our economy would have opened up the way that it did had the governor not been under recall scrutiny. I don't think our kids would have been back to school as quickly as they were. And granted, we were last in the nation to get our kids back to school had it not been for a recall. I certainly don't think that we would have seen our governor underneath a freeway overpass cleaning up trash had it not been for that recall effort and talking about issues that were important. At a statewide level, it is definitely a heavy lift, and we are still working on engaging in more communities and bringing our message everywhere we possibly can. But we did see some huge successes in 2020, which is actually building the infrastructure of what we're going to be able to do in 2022. Mm-hmm.
Well, that brings me to the governor's race. Who was running against Governor Newsom? Those who ran against him and lost in the recall, not giving it another try, including Larry Elder, who received the most votes. I mean, given that the primaries are less than 5 months away, is the party conceding? Because we haven't really heard of a candidate or a party like kind of going behind a candidate.
There's a lot of work that's being done behind the scenes. I think you're going to hear some announcements very, very soon. I'm not going to step on anybody's toes, but there's some exciting things that are happening. In addition to that, we do have an endorsement procedure where we can get behind a candidate, and that would take place at our April convention. But the work that we've really been doing is really in these targeted districts. We're looking for the places, we know that we are going to be outspent. $100 million is a lot of money. And we have to be more efficient and more effective with every single dollar that we raise. And the places that we can really affect change, we see most clearly, is on those congressional seats. We put the infrastructure in place and, in fact, led the entire country. There were more new Republicans that were sent to the House of Representatives from California than any other state in the nation. We played in four seats. We won those four seats. For the first time since 1994, we took out Democrat incumbents. We have another opportunity to build upon that and make sure that the Speaker of the House isn't just from California, but a Republican from California.
Well, given that, redistricting has left many elected officials across party lines to reevaluate and strategize the best path forward. That obviously happens every decade based on census data. But at the level of Congress that you're talking about, Representative Devin Nunes' seat is now vacant, leaving to head former President Trump's new social media company. That leaves a gap and also kind of a hectic election cycle, a special election to replace him, seamlessly going into a midterm election primary in general. How does your party navigate three elections in 11 months, one that will look very different from the other two because of redistricting?
Yeah, well, we can certainly walk and chew gum at the same time. And so what you're probably going to see is, you know, we have a few candidates that have already announced for the special election. I honestly don't think that we're finished with the announcements on that special election, whether it's someone who will take it on as a caretaker role or end up running in a different seat because all of the seats changed. As we mentioned before, for the first time in our history, we lost a congressional seat. So every single congressional seat was going to change no matter what. But I think that that is something that we can absolutely navigate. And, you know, with it being a strong Republican seat, I think this is an opportunity for someone to get in there, serve this community for the next few months and, you know, look towards what the future holds for that individual.
Yeah, as you mentioned, during the 2020 elections, the GOP did flip 4 of 7 California House seats that were lost in the 2018 midterms. Looking to the 2022 midterms, just a few months away, what other districts and regions of the state is your party prioritizing for in the midterms?
Yeah, on the congressional side, certainly we're going to be focused on protecting those 4 seats that we picked up. So from north to south, that's Congressman David Valadeo in the Central Valley, Congressman Mike Garcia in the Los Angeles area. Then down in Orange County, we've got Congresswoman Young Kim and Congresswoman Michelle Park Steele. So the other opportunities that we look at in 2022 right now, the McNerney seat got a little bit better for us. I think with the right candidate, that is certainly a seat that we will be playing in. The seat that now Josh Congressman Harder is running in, which is a portion of his current district, a little bit further east as well. That will definitely be a seat that we are playing in. And then moving down south, we've got another seat in Orange County, which is coastal. Congresswoman Katie Porter has moved further to the coast and is running in that district. There's a fantastic candidate, Scott Baugh, former Assembly Republican leader, raised $500,000 in 3 weeks. Certainly, people are excited about that race. I think that's a great opportunity for us. And then further south, southern part of Orange County, northern part of San Diego, in the Levin seat. That seat also got a little bit better for us. And I think with the right candidate in this cycle, we could pick up there as well.
You know, just going off of what our political reporter Nicole Nixon just reported on in the previous segment, California is flush with cash to the tune of $45 billion budget surplus. Before we get to how you'd like that money to be spent, are there a few places where you think the governor's proposal actually gets it right?
So I think on wildfires, that investment, you know, I encourage that. What we don't want to see is what we saw last year. Right. With him putting this money forward and then lying to us about what he actually accomplished. And I think it was Cap Radio that actually broke that story where, you know, he told us that he had done, you know, overstated what he did by 690% on forest fire mitigation, prescribed burns. So I think the amount of money that they are looking to invest in wildfires is fantastic. What I would like to see is honesty and transparency from this governor.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with California GOP Chairwoman Jessica Milan Patterson. Now, heading to national, former President Trump is obviously not on the ballot this year, but his influence and presence is still front and center. People say the Republican Party is the party of Trump. How do you respond to that when it comes to California Republicans?
Well, I think that President Trump brought, you know, a lot of people into the fold that hadn't, you know, necessarily been engaged in politics before. And I think here in California, what we are constantly talking about are the issues that matter to people that are affecting their everyday life. You talk about California being flush with cash. Well, the California government is flush with cash. We have the highest unemployment in the entire nation. California working families are feeling the pinch. We're now at a 40-year high inflation rate. And so for us in California, we're going to continue to talk about the issues that matter to Californians and how California Democrats have affected their everyday lives.
Yeah, there is a timeliness to our conversation this morning. Earlier this morning on NPR Morning Edition, President Trump was interviewed by Steve Inskeep at a time when the former president is still falsely claiming the 2020 election was rigged. I just want to play a small excerpt to get your reaction, keeping in mind the upcoming midterm election. Let's take a listen.
Are you telling Republicans in 2022 that they must press your case on the past election in order to get your endorsement? Is that an absolute?
They're going to do whatever they want to do. Whatever they have to do, they're going to do. But the ones that are smart, the ones that know, people have no idea how big this issue is, and they don't want it to happen again. It shouldn't be allowed to happen, and they don't want it to happen again. And the only way it's not going to happen again is you have to solve the problem of the presidential rigged election of 2020.
First off, Chairwoman, you have nearly 20 years in state and national politics, leadership positions with Governor Schwarzenegger, Senator John McCain. Was the 2020 election rigged or stolen? Do you stand by the former president?
My focus has always been on California. And very clearly here in California, we had worked hard on election integrity. We have developed here in the California Republican Party an election integrity committee and team. So we didn't start this post-2020. This was before the 2020 election. We had over 60% of the ballots here in California, specifically in those targeted seats, that were watched by lawyer staff and volunteers. When you win seats by 333 votes, like we did with Mike Garcia, it's critical that you have transparency. I certainly do believe that there were places around the country where they did not allow sunlight on the process. And if you are doing nothing wrong, and rules for elections are different in every state and sometimes by counties. If you are not allowing sunlight in on the process, then you are doing a disservice, not only to the voters, but to yourself. Here in California, we did a really good job of engaging with county clerks throughout the state, having that dialogue and relationship. I am confident in the California election system.
Yeah. And nationally, it has been exhaustingly challenged by the former president, and it keeps hitting dead ends because it simply did not happen. The 2020 election wasn't rigged or stolen. It was fair. And this comes days after Republican Senator Mike Rounds from South Dakota took to ABC News saying, quote, "We simply did not win the election as Republicans for the presidency. If we simply look back and tell our people don't vote because there's cheating going on, then we're going to put ourselves in a huge disadvantage." Do you agree that continuing this conversation, which isn't true, can hurt GOP voter turnout in California come midterms?
Well, we have always talked about the work that we've done on election integrity to help bring confidence to voters. And that's exactly what we want to do. We want to make sure that people have faith inside their elections. The work that we do on election integrity helps make that possible.
Do you think former President Trump's absence will shape Republican voter turnout for the midterms?
I think that, you know, President Trump brings a whole new dynamic to every single election. And, you know, there are some people that will turn out just because of him.
A poll by the Pew Research Center last year found that Trump had a 10-point gain in Hispanic voters for 2020 compared to 2016. How do you retain that growth?
Well, it's continuing to do the engagement that's necessary within these communities throughout our state. So this is something that we have been working on, prior and helped build up that support once I was elected in 2019. We cannot continue to ignore communities throughout our state and expect to be successful. We have to show up. You know, we saw that within these different and diverse communities throughout our state, they weren't living their best lives because of the policies of California Democrats. And in fact, by any milestone or metric that you looked at, their lives were worse off. But Democrats were showing up, and Democrats made them feel like they cared about their problems. We needed to show up. We needed to engage, we needed to listen, and we needed to show them solutions. And that's what we did. That's what we're going to continue to do, because I think that this is what is going to help with that turning point here in California.
Yeah, I was looking at the Secretary of State's office with voter registration, and overall from 2003 to 2018, the California Republican Party has dropped in registration numbers, but that changed in 2020. The state GOP added more than 500,000 registered voters. Democrats also gained in registration as well. But focusing on the 500,000 boost for your party, are there specific parts of the state that this is happening, or is it kind of sprinkled all over?
Yeah, we have taken a really hands-on approach when it comes to voter registration. Everything from new digital programs to engagement within communities, going to farms and working with farm workers and registering to vote. People that want to hear the message of, we want safer streets, we want better schools for our children, and we want to make sure that there's good jobs out there for people to go to. So we've taken on a really hands-on approach. You're absolutely right. For the better part of a decade, we lost market share. Every single report that came from the Secretary of State. My first report as chair came out in the October of 2019, it was the first time in 10 years we didn't lose market share, we gained market share. You gave some numbers in the beginning of the segment with Republicans, Democrats, and decline to states. As of May of 2018, we had actually become the third largest party in the state if decline to states were organized as a party. We surpassed them in July of 2020. And we haven't looked back since then. This is something that we will continue to build upon. One of the things that's hurting us is certainly conservatives that are leaving the state for places that more align with their values. We're here to fight. We're here to turn the corner. And it's going to take building that registration to do it.
What does it tell you that decline to state, no party preference has more than doubled in that same time frame from 2003 to now?
Yeah, I think that, decline to states have taken from both of the parties. And, I've always tried to approach the leadership side of being the chair with, open conversations and talking about things that matter to people and affect their everyday lives. And I think that some of the rhetoric can get, incredibly harsh. And at the end of the day, people just want solutions. They want to be able to walk their kids to school and not pass by homeless encampments. They want to be able to go to a good job so they can provide for their families. They want to make sure that their children are getting their best education. And what we saw from the education department's numbers this past week, they're really failing our children. And so I think that when you talk to people about those issues, it can help persuade them. But certainly we have some work to do.
But given, how does your party go beyond that criticism, beyond, quote, failed policies of Democrats, unquote, to create effective, tangible change that people can feel and see when ultimately you need to get things through, policies through a Democrat supermajority at the state capitol?
Yeah, I think that it's winning more races. And that's what we've tried to build upon in the last cycle and definitely this cycle. If we don't win races, the rhetoric doesn't matter. All of the ideas and policy solutions that we have for Californians won't matter. So we have to win more races.
Chairwoman Patterson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Vicki.
Jessica Milan Patterson is the chairwoman of the California Republican Party. Still ahead, the Sacramento Public Library is among the largest in the state. The head of the library system joins us as she embarks on a new chapter, a well-deserved retirement. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome Welcome back to Inside on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. One of the most transformative chapters in the Sacramento Public Library's 142-year history is about to come to a close. Rivka Sass, the library system's president and CEO, is retiring after an extraordinary 12-year tenure. In 2009, she took the helm of a library system deep in crisis. But under her guidance, she turned the state's fourth largest library system into an award-winning and innovative institution. Sass helped redefine a library's role, going beyond books by establishing key educational, social, and civic programs to support those most in need in the community. And although she's retiring, she's kind of hinted that she doesn't plan on slowing down anytime soon. So here with us to reflect on her career and to share what she's planning to do next is the soon-to-be former president and CEO of the Sacramento Public Library herself, Rivka Sass. Rivka, welcome back to Insight. Congratulations on your retirement.
Thank you, Vicky. It's a thrill to be here with you.
It's a thrill to have you. You know, you recently said, I love my job, and that's probably why it's the right time to go. Can you kind of share with us those mixed, bittersweet emotions that you were wrestling with in your decision to retire?
Well, it really is bittersweet. And my late husband was a clinical social worker who worked a lot with kids. And his advice always was stop at the high point. And while I can't exactly call the last 3 years the high point of my career, they've been really important. And getting through a tragedy, getting through, you know, working through a pandemic, I still have a lot of energy. It's time to go, and it's time to bring in a new person who has the energy, the vision, and the wherewithal to open the next chapter, no pun intended, of Sacramento Public Library.
When did the library bug bite you?
Oh, when I was a child. I actually my dad took me to the local public library. I grew up in Manteca, left California for many years, but my roots are in this area, really. And my dad took me to the library and explained about borrowing books and bringing them back. He was an avid reader. And I always loved the library. It was my safe haven. It was my, even when I wasn't too successful in school, it was my safe haven. Mm-hmm. And when it came time to really think about what I wanted to do with life, that was it.
You were a former children's librarian. I'm just curious, how has the purpose and the use of a library evolved over that time?
Wow. Well, when I became a children's librarian, we were a necessary but sort of there was sort of a grudging respect for what we did as children's librarians. And from the minute I started, I knew that partnerships were essential. And I think it's just evolved to what you see today. And Sacramento Public Library is an incredible example of that, with a K-12 specialist who works with our 14 school districts here in Sacramento County, with our early learning department, which is seen as a model now for other libraries. So those are the kinds of things. I've loved that evolution because the future is here and it's in our children.
You said that you believe the role of a library is a convener. Can you unpack what exactly that means? Help us visualize that.
Okay. Well, you know, it's really important, especially in today's world, that we come together. And the library as that space that provides, you know, as much objectivity as we can is, I think, the perfect community convener. We're that space where you can have uncomfortable conversations, where, you know, people of different parties, different faiths, different ideologies can actually sit down and have a civil conversation. Libraries are critical in our civil society, and I think that role is even more important than ever.
When you started in 2009, the Sacramento library system was embroiled in a scandal after two former employees were arrested on a bribery scheme and a scathing grand jury report critical of the library's leadership. I mean, at that time, you said you welcomed the challenge of turning around the library's reputation. What inspired you to take on a challenge, an arduous challenge, that others may have shied away from?
Well, I won't go into my strengths and how much I really love the Clifton Strengths Finder and all of that, but I urge everyone to look into it. But I love to fix things. I've always been a tinkerer. And honestly, when I read about Sacramento Public Library, and I just thought, wow, I would love to be part of fixing that. And it's taken the entire staff, a wonderful board, an amazing staff, and a community to make all of those things happen. But I think I can do this kind of attitude. And, you know, it's the old saying about there's got to be a pony in there somewhere when you come across the manure pile. There wasn't just a pony, there was a whole herd.
Yeah, there were a lot of ponies. I mean, during your tenure, the library earned national acclaim, and some of the programs that you introduced are inspiring similar programs at libraries across the country. But through all of that, or within all of that, do you have any kind of regrets, or was there anything incomplete that you wish you could have achieved before you retired?
Oh, so many things. And I was working on the list while I was listening to the program. So many things, but you know, the door is closing in 56 hours or whatever the end of the day on Friday is. And I have a long list for Peter Coyle, our new director, and I know he's up to the challenge.
Peter Coyle was the director of the Montclair Public Library in New Jersey before coming here, has over 20 years of library experience. He also received his very first library card, apparently, at the age of 5, right here in Sacramento. What are some of the biggest challenges and opportunities do you think Mr. Coyle will face as he begins his tenure?
I think honestly, the challenge always is getting to know the staff, making sure everybody's okay. This has been an incredibly hard time, and we thought it would be over so long ago. And I think that's an opportunity. I don't know about challenge. I think honestly, it's mostly opportunities for him, although there are quite a few policies I didn't manage to get written before I walk out the door. But again, I know he's up to the challenge, and I know he's going to do a fantastic job. And I've had the opportunity to get to know him over these last couple of weeks, and I am so excited as a library user that he is here.
You could pass along some rough drafts before you lock the office. Well, you're retiring at the end of the week, but you have no plans on slowing down. What do you plan to do? And I guess kind of write in the next chapters of your life.
Well, I've always loved to travel, but that is not in the cards right now.
Probably
so
not
I will
right
dream.
Now.
Yeah, I will dream of traveling. I've said often I'd love to live on a narrow boat on the canals of England for a while. I don't think that's in the cards anytime soon, and rescue donkeys on the Isle of Wight. I don't think that's in the cards anytime soon, but I've got some things that I'm looking at and hope to get started in the next few weeks about advocating. I feel very passionate about the ability, you know, it starts with early learning. That's why I'm so passionate about that at the library. But I also want to advocate for those people who have not had the opportunity to succeed in school, and they're now adults and they're up against all of those challenges. So that's what I hope to put some energy into, and maybe cleaning my house a little thoroughly, those kinds of things. But definitely travel, road trips, working, seeing my grandkids. They live in Idaho. And they're adorable, of course, and they're very young. So it's important that they know who their Nana is.
Yeah. I get why you say that libraries are a convener. I go back to when I was a kid, I would go to the library every day after school, waiting for my dad to pick me up. And I made some of my best friends there to this very day. Very true.
Exactly. Exactly. And you think about it. We brought in everybody, even during COVID, just before COVID, we had Dr. Cornel West, and we were bursting at the seams that evening, and it was 2 days after Christmas. That to me was, that was a high point. We had Secretary, former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, do an author visit, and your own Donna Appadoni was the interviewer. And yes,
we adore
and love. And that was something so special. So we bring people together for those conversations and those experiences. Absolutely.
And relationships.
And friendships.
Friendships and relationships with books. Those are very important. Rivka Sass is the former president, or soon to be former president, and CEO of the Sacramento Public Library. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on a well-deserved retirement.
Thank you. Thank you.
That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.